This is Bloomberg Intelligence.
Uber wants to beat Amazon of retail, of e-commerce.
The Disney Plus service might actually end up benefiting Netflix.
In-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
Capital return is the key story for the U.S. banks.
The telcos naturally are moving into content distribution. I think it's a good move.
Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Over the next hour, we're going to dig inside the big business stories impacting Wall Street and the global markets.
Each and every week, we provide in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries our analysts cover worldwide.
Today, we're going to take a look at why emerging markets still have room to advance.
Plus, we'll delve into stocks that missed the green recovery rally.
But we want to begin with why trends can be your friends in emerging markets foreign exchange. Going to walk us through it all is Bloomberg Intelligence Chief Emerging Markets Strategist Damian Sassauer. Okay, so Damian, first of all, you need to set the scene for us here. We've seen a very big rally in U.S. rates. What has that done to emerging markets? Where are we?
Sure. Well, I mean, rising U.S. rates have basically eaten into emerging market gains, specifically on the fixed income side this year. I believe we are off something on the order of 1.5% to 2.5% across both EM hard and local currency debt this year. The one area of respite has been financials, right? So the reflationary theme still picks up, a steeper curve. Rising rates down on the long end should really fuel financials. And we've seen them rally quite considerably in recent weeks, Alex.
All right, Damian, so give us a sense of kind of the risk factors that emerging markets investors are really focusing on right now.
Sure. I mean, Paul, it's always good to be ahead of the game, right? So nearly 4 years ago, when Bloomberg acquired the Barclays Risk and Index business, I sat down with their systematic research team, and we concluded that, you know, with global yields and structural decline, currencies were going to play a much more dominant role in determining total returns for investors in EM. And now fast forward to today, you know, we live in a world where not only developed market yields are low, if not negative, but so are those across EM. And this means it is all about getting the FX right when investing in non-US dollar asset classes. So what we've done here is we've broken down EM currency risk into its three constituent parts, those being carry value and trend being the darling. And the results are nothing short of spectacular. I mean, our work provides a blueprint for offshore investors looking to extract their EM currency exposure and replace it with, dare I say, a smarter and more profitable approach.
Okay, you just answered all the three questions that you sent us. So now what are we going to do for the next, like, 7 minutes of the segment? He's like, you guys got my questions? Let's do my questions. And he answers all his questions in 30 seconds. Okay, can you back it up a sec and talk about some of the risk factors in the market for this?
Sure, sure. So, Alex, there are really three primary risk factors: carry, value, and trend. When you talk about EM carry, I mean, we're really building on the concept of interest rate parity, right? Basically saying that spot forward price differentials should, in theory, reflect the gap in interest rates between two countries. And we broke it down, and we find that EM carry offers the promise of steady returns over time, yet it suffers from sharp drawdowns during periods of market distress. If you look at EM value, we build on that concept of purchasing power parity. You know, basically the cost of a basket of goods in one country should be identical to another in the absence of trade friction. And again, we find a higher absolute return over time, yet the risk-reward profile is far from attractive given the volatility and the drawdown risk. Now we shift to EM trend, and this is the darling when you're breaking down EM FX into its constituent parts, because we all know that EM currencies tend to overshoot. And so what we employ is a diversified signaling methodology that basically generates superior absolute risk-adjusted returns over time, and it capitalizes on the numerous sort of structural and behavioral biases inherent to EM, the dollar effect, structural biases like the outside presence of nonprofit-oriented participants, or commercial hedgers, central banks across EM, and behavioral biases like disposition and herding, confirmation bias, the bandwagon effect, all of which seem to be heightened in less efficient markets such as those we find in EM. So you take it in combination, and that's really what we've done. We've broken them down, we've recombined them, and we found a better mousetrap.
So what does this mousetrap tell you and your clients about where they should be allocating capital across the EM space?
Sure. So, I mean, really what it's designed to be is more of an overlay, Paul. So if you have existing investments in emerging markets and non-dollar assets, let's say we were to strip out all of the FX impact, which is easy to do today. You get a much higher Sharpe, but your returns fall fantastically. So just to give you a sense of it, you know, you might get on EM local currency government bonds, a 3.6% return since per annum since 2008, which, as you can imagine, is far from adequate given pension funds and, you know, yield-oriented investors looking for that magical 6% handle. So what we do is we strip out all the FX exposure, we recombine them in a smart way, and what it does is it takes that 3.6% return to 6% without materially adding vol and drawdown risk to the portfolio. So it's a really kind of novel approach. It's one that seems to be working over different time horizons, and it's actually performed even better in recent years.
It's very cool. And honestly, and I'm not just saying this because I work at Bloomberg, but it does really give you a sense of like what Bloomberg Intelligence does here. Like, it goes far beyond just a regular old analyst for the sell side. So based on that, where are you noticing you're going to get good returns here?
Well, it's interesting, right? I mean, you know, when you combine it all together and you look at where, you know, which countries are really driving, you know, driving returns at the margin, you know, on the value and carry portfolios, they're clearly telling you to get long the real deep value distressed plays like Brazil and Turkey, right?
Yes.
You know, and vice versa, it's telling you to get short, you know, those currencies that have performed rather well, like Taiwan and the Asian surplus currencies. So it's sort of counterintuitive.
Okay, Damian, thanks a lot. Bloomberg Intelligence Chief Emerging Markets Strategist Damian Sassauer.
Coming up on the program, staying on EM and why global economic recovery is supporting the small gap in the emerging markets versus U.S. risk premium.
You are listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 13 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
While our next guest writes that there's still room for MSCI Emerging Market Index upside, for more, we welcome Bloomberg Intelligence Head of Emerging Market Equity Strategy, Gaurav Patankar. Gaurav, thanks so much for joining us here. So give us your call here as it relates to the some of the U.S. indices versus some of our international peers.
Thanks, Paul. It's always a pleasure to be here. So we continue to see emerging markets outperforming the global indices, including the S&P. We think that run will continue, and our model predicts roughly 8% upside. That's the headline number. But I think within that, there are some very interesting opportunities that are emerging within the emerging markets index, especially as the commodity super cycle begins to take hold, which naturally would shrink the risk premium of emerging markets versus the developed markets.
We were just talking to Damian Sassauer earlier about the screens that they use to filter in and out FX risk. And the basic thesis is going to also rely on U.S. yields, where they go, how fast they get there. And he was saying, look, as long as they don't go too high too fast, like emerging markets should be okay. And just on a macro level, is that something that you're also seeing?
Well, thinking about yields is way beyond my pay grade, but as an equity analyst, I'll say this, that if Damian feels very good about yield, I completely agree with him, for emerging markets to kind of continue their fiscal spending. And I think we are seeing a whole lot of prime pumping within various markets, commodities healing a little bit, yields, again, as correctly put, not going too far too fast. It's a perfect timing for emerging markets to heal, prime their pump, and do a little bit of fiscal spending.
Yeah, Gaurav, give us a sense of, you know, this feels like a you know, obviously a reopening play. But just looking at past cycles, have emerging markets broadly defined kind of moved with, you know, more developed markets coming out of, you know, deep contractions?
So that's a great question. We actually did a little bit of a regression analysis on emerging markets. And what we find, emerging markets versus some of the developed, and when you compare, say, emerging markets MXCF to MSCI World Index, there is almost a 90% correlation of how those returns pan out. And for example, for every 100 basis point change in the S&P 500 index returns, there's 118 basis point change for emerging markets indices. So especially in a recovery type play, coming out of the recovery, we think emerging markets would be a little bit of a levered beta to S&P. So there is a correlation as all of these markets recover.
What if we're in a commodity super cycle? Who wins, who loses?
That's a great question again. Commodities is an interesting topic for emerging markets because there are some clear commodity haves like Brazil, Mexico, mm-hmm. some of the Middle Eastern countries, Russia. But there are clearly some of the commodity not-haves like China, India, and others who suffer if there's a disorderly move in commodities. Our expectation is for, you know, a good commodity super cycle to set in, but net-net, a commodity super cycle actually helps emerging markets. So we have actually done some analysis on this. This, in fact, you know, what we see is the implied 2.2% long-term EM risk premium to U.S. equities actually narrows down during a commodity super cycle, which essentially means that the differential between the U.S. and the EM multiples. Right now, we are projecting EMs to be about 16 times. The U.S. markets are at 22 times. And that will actually shrink if a commodity super cycle holds up. So it's actually very positive for emerging markets.
Are there any particular areas of the world that you're looking at may offer maybe the best return areas or sectors?
Absolutely. We are most excited about a couple of the value-oriented emerging markets. So we are very, very constructive on ASEAN, where we find the risk-reward to be one of the most reasonable risk-rewards you ever see in that region. A lot of capital withdrawn there, a lot of structural opportunity and reopening, playing in countries such as Thailand, which are extremely dependent on tourists and the like. We really like Latin America on the back of the super cycle, specifically Brazil, where expectations are very low and things are coming off of a low base. Mexico, which is largely helped by trade, nearshoring of supply chains, so very, very constructive on that. And if one really has a mid to long-term view, we are extremely constructive on India, where we actually believe that over the next 3 to 4 years, on the back of the structural reforms, and despite potential commodity headwinds, there's a significant runway as there's a declogging of the economy, bank balance sheets healing, and corporate structure spending kicking in, not to mention the government sector spending coming on board as well.
You mentioned government sector spending for India, so I wonder like how you view the cooperation between fiscal and monetary policy in the countries that are sort of longer-term bets?
That's a very prescient question, because I think the coordination in policy is what we have been talking about. And it's not just the monetary and the fiscal policy. I would add a third field to this, which is the strategic policy or the geostrategic alignment. India, just taking that as an example, which is one of our most prominent long-term calls, we believe that in India, all of these policies are in sync. So if you look at the monetary trajectory followed by the Reserve Bank of India, they have been playing both offense and defense, mopping up excess liquidity, putting in liquidity when needed, married that with the fiscal plan put out in the budget, where there was a lot of energy, but then immediately the monetary forces acted to kind of, take off any of the excess within the markets. And then the geostrategic alignment in terms of getting foreign direct investments and longer-term investors into the country, all of that has been working in tandem. And we like that. We see that in Indonesia. We see that to a limited extent in Mexico. And these are three of our top markets.
What do we think about China right here? I mean, it seems like the trade tensions, thankfully, have kind of ratcheted down a little bit, although tariffs are still there. But I know China is such a big part of the emerging market call.
Yeah, China is 50% of emerging markets and perhaps occupies even more of the mind space, given the various moving parts. Having said that, we think we are in the camp that some of the traditional sectors in China are going to get a few tailwinds here. So we think that the higher valuation, high expectation, Chinese consumer discretionary or Chinese tech stocks are going to take a little bit of a breather here, if not move in a slightly downward direction. But some of the more traditional sectors like real estate, banks, and other industrials could actually get a little bit of a bid as the economy takes a bit of a healing process. And we also see a little bit of more domestic travel and domestic activity and a pro-cyclical policy. So we feel good about old China. We don't like new China. So at one end, you have a policy that's focused on being the most high-tech nation in the world. At the other end, there's a policy focused on kind of putting more people in houses and putting more people in jobs.
Our thanks to Bloomberg Intelligence head of EM equity strategy, Gaurav Patankar.
I feel like I need to rewatch that to make sure I understood everything the last 20 minutes of EM. That was really amazing for both of our analysts there. Coming up in the program, we'll talk about green recovery picks. We're going to look past those usual suspects.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BIGO on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney.
And I'm Alex Steele. It is 25 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
text, and whatever. Just don't text and drive. Visit StopTextsStopWrecks.org. A message from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
We'll be here each and every week at this time, tapping into our Bloomberg Intelligence analyst covering some 2,000 companies and 130 industries worldwide.
Well, time now to look at our Bloomberg Intelligence Green Recovery Tracker and 2021 investment ideas. Joining us now to walk us through them is Bloomberg Intelligence Head of ESG and Thematic Investing EMEA, Adeline Diab. Adeline, what is your recovery tracker that you guys have?
So we have designed a green recovery tracker since post all the announcements from the $3 trillion fiscal stimulus to all the green policies that have been announced, we have seen the green stocks rise significantly. There has been a market rally. And so we have designed a green recovery tracker since we believe the market is looking past the usual suspect. And these are stocks that Bloomberg Intelligence analysts believe they have differentiated business models, stronger growth than the consensus, and lagging valuation. Some are trading at half the multiples of the benchmark, even six times lower than pure renewable energy players. So these are companies in transport, infrastructure, energy that represent over $430 billion in revenue that our analysts believe they are well positioned to benefit from higher sales and profit as a result of these wave of green policies. And the EBIT growth we are seeing for these companies could be 37 higher than the stock 600 in Europe, because we're initiating our green recovery tracker with European stocks.
So, Adeline, give us a sense of some of the companies that screened well for you in terms of, you know, this green recovery in Europe.
Well, I'll give you two examples that I think are quite interesting. The first one is Volkswagen, which is expected to surpass, or the electric vehicle sales of Volkswagen could surpass Tesla's by 2023. Yet its valuation remains depressed at 32 times lower than Tesla. So basically, Tesla is at 60 times EV/EBITDA, whilst Volkswagen is at 2 times. So there is a complete disconnect. And although Volkswagen Dieselgate may weigh on the brand, it's still quite a big disconnect again. And another company that we found very interesting is Alstom, which is the largest global pure player for rail equipment, following its acquisition of Bombardier, a rail unit, for example. And in Europe, it has been announced as the year of rail, and numerous multi-billion euro initiatives are being rolled out to lower carbon emissions. So again, these green initiatives could further boost Alstom's order backlog. So these are two examples that are very interesting amongst the 11 we have identified.
Part of the conversation going into this downturn over the last year was that ESG stocks were just running with tech stocks. And then once we saw a big sell-off and momentum out of tech, you'd also see it out of ESG plays. Now that we have some experience with that thesis, like, has that actually happened? Or is the green recovery a little bit more resilient than we thought?
The green recovery may bring further resilience to these names, because, again, it's a multi-year plan. In Europe, it's a seven-year minimum plan. But, for example, green infrastructure, the EU renovation strategy for is planning 250 billion capital spending per year until 2050. So again, it's multi-year in Europe, but I think it's certainly also true in the U.S. With Biden climate action plan, and where, well, infrastructure investment are definitely needed. And as we recently saw with what happened in Texas, for example.
So Adeline, you mentioned, you know, the U.S. versus Europe, and it's clear that when we look at some of the fiscal stimulus coming out of the pandemic and even before that, but Europe has been so much further along in terms of governmental support and funding for, you know, green initiatives on grand scales. Give us a sense of kind of what the thinking was during some of these fiscal stimulus packages over the last year. How much were they focusing on really, you know, kind of green investment?
So Europe has earmarked 25% of its COVID fiscal stimulus to the green recovery. So again, the main industries are electric vehicles, renewable energy, and green infrastructure. I think the U.S. is a Green New Deal is also definitely top of mind. And the and funny enough, I would say the upcoming China 14th Year Plan will definitely, or we expect that it will have strong environmental policies and again, stimulus.
Really great conversation. Thank you so much, Adeline Diop. She's Bloomberg Intelligence, head of ESG and thematic investing, EMEA.
Coming up on the program, could banks and retailers get higher taxes in the year ahead?
You are listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies in 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 39 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, time now to look at banks and retailers. Our next guest points out that tech, banks, and retail may see double tax on foreign credit rules. Joining us now is the tax man, Bloomberg Intelligence government analyst Andrew Silverman. Okay, what does that mean, double tax on foreign credit rules? What does that mean?
Well, so we got these foreign tax credit regulations. They were proposed in the middle of November last year, and you might be thinking, okay, so why are we talking about it now? We're talking about it now because they were proposed then. They're now going to be finalized by the Biden administration, proposed by the Trump administration, finalized by the Biden administration. And you might think that's odd that the Biden administration would agree with something that the Trump administration has proposed, but it could be a very large revenue raiser for the administration, and it's a good way for the Biden Treasury Department to raise revenue without having to go to Congress to actually change tax laws.
All right. So give us a sense of kind of what are the sectors that could be impacted here going forward?
Yeah, it's actually really broad. So the companies that wrote letters to the Treasury Department to complain about the regulations are SIFMA, the National Association of Manufacturers, SIFMA being asset managers and banks, the software coalition, the semiconductor industry. So it's very, very broad. And the reason that it's so broad is because the regulation is written quite broadly. It basically requires that foreign taxes that U.S. companies would pay have to comply with U.S. tax principles in order for companies to get a foreign tax credit. And it was originally aimed at digital taxes that are being promulgated in Europe and now in Asia and South America and other places. But the regulations are even broader than just digital taxes. And so that's why all these other organizations are writing into the Treasury Department as well.
Okay, so just dumb this one down for me in terms of what they would get taxed. So whatever they're making overseas, they'd also be taxed on here?
Yeah. So it's interesting. The United States has the view that companies should only be taxed on where they produce value. And the United States says, well, companies produce value in the United States if they're headquartered in the United States. Apple is headquartered in the United States, Google, all these companies. And the French and the Germans and other countries are saying, well, we actually think that companies should be taxed on where they make their revenue. And since they make so much revenue in France and Germany, we should apply the tax based on that, not where the countries are incorporated. But the United States doesn't really care what the Europeans think, and they're going to continue applying tax in the United States. And so companies are being taxed twice in Europe and in South America and Asia and in the United States on that same income. And usually when this happens, the United States says, okay, well, we'll give you a foreign tax credit for the taxes that you're suffering outside the U.S., and so you're made whole. But in this case, the U.S. is saying, we're not going to give you a credit for the taxes you're paying in Europe because we don't agree with those taxes.
So okay. Good. Dumb it down.
exactly. So, you know, the government is saying it's all well and good that you're going to pay these taxes, but we don't agree with them, and so we're not going to support the Europeans in applying those taxes to you.
All right. So, I mean, I've heard, you know, I guess I've heard about this most notably with some of the big tech companies, Amazon, Facebook, Alphabet. They've got big advertising businesses and just big businesses across the world. What are those kinds of companies saying?
What are the digital companies saying about it?
Yeah.
Well, obviously they don't like it because
they're like, thanks, I'd love to pay more.
Exactly.
First and foremost, because the taxes are different in every country that's passing these rules. So, you know, the British have a tax not only on advertising revenue, but on social media and other things. And the French are just focused on the advertising revenue, and the Polish are focused on video on demand. And so it's being applied in all these countries in totally different ways. And so they're being taxed under, you know, very disparate regimes all over the place. And the OECD is trying to come up with a template where countries can sort of agree on how a digital company is going to be taxed. Mm-hmm. But the U.S. doesn't buy into that. And so even if the OECD comes up with something, the U.S. is going to argue with them. And so we're probably never going to have a unified regime that digital companies are going to be taxed on all around the world. It's always going to be different.
So let me ask this question. Obviously, Made in America is a thing. And it's a thing whether or not you're a Democrat or Republican. So if you're a tech company, for example, and you bring your chip making back to the U.S., but you still kind of need to outsource some stuff or you need to get some things, is that going to help you? Like, what's the incentive here to move everything back into the U.S.?
Well, yeah, that's sort of the problem. The United States obviously passed the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act to get companies to move things back into the U.S., but these digital taxes don't follow the same thought process, the same philosophy. And so if you bring things back to the United States, if you expand to the United States, it doesn't matter to the countries that are applying the digital tax. If you're selling things in France, if you're selling things in Germany, they apply the tax nonetheless. So it doesn't matter, you know, the repatriation tax, the beat the guilty, all these sorts of things that are trying to force you to bring your revenue back to the States and hire people in the States. Digital taxes don't have anything to do with that. They're going to apply regardless.
All right, Andrew.
Makes the U.S. so upset about it.
Yeah. Before we let you go, Andrew, what's the thinking right now that among corporate America, what President-elect Biden and his administration is going to do to the corporate tax rate?
So I've gotten this question quite a bit recently, as you might not be surprised about. The issue is that the House might pass an increase in the corporate tax rate. He wants to go up to 28%. The Senate is probably not going to support that. And so you have a situation in which you might be able to bump up the rate a little bit, maybe 22%, maybe 23%, but that's not going to be enough to pay for the things that President Biden wants to fund with that type of revenue increase. And so So, you know, these regulations are a way to sort of get around that. Even if the corporate tax rate isn't increased to 28%, the Treasury Department can pass these regulations that increase the effective tax rate of companies up a bit by, you know, just tightening the regulations, by saying you can't get a foreign tax credit for taxes you pay outside of the United States, for saying you can't get a deduction for the interest that you're paying. And so even if you can't increase the statutory rate, he can bring in more tax revenue anyway, just by tweaking the regulations.
Oh, man. it's going to be a nightmare. Okay. Andrew, thanks a lot. I appreciate it. Andrew Silverman, a government analyst with Bloomberg Intelligence.
All right. Switching our focus to European banks, their capital levels may decline in 2021. For more, let's bring in Bloomberg Intelligence senior credit analyst Yaron Julius. Yaron, give us a sense here. Let's step back 30,000 feet here. Month 12, arguably, of this financial crisis bred by the pandemic. Just give us a sense of how the balance sheets for European banks look right now.
Yeah. So all European banks have now reported their full year numbers. And one of the key conclusions to draw is that regulatory capital buffers have reached all-time highs. Now, that's partly a function of earnings retention. Banks in the European Union and also in the United Kingdom, they were not allowed to pay out dividends and to do any share buybacks last year in order to ensure that lending to the real economy was not constrained while COVID was raging. The Swiss banks had a slightly more leeway. So most banks in Europe, they were profitable last year despite low interest rates. So all that capital had been building up and has now reached very high levels. But there's another factor at play, namely what's been happening on the regulatory front. So higher regulatory capital buffers are also a function of lower capital requirements. So regulators have been reducing banks' capital requirements in the wake of the crisis back in March of last year. Again, this was to ensure that lending to the real economy was not constrained. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you cast your mind forward to what's going to happen this year, you know, what are banks going to do with all this capital? Well, they are likely to resume paying dividends and do share buybacks, and the central banks are okay with that, the regulators, but within fairly strict limits. So, you know, the risks to the real economy, they are still pretty substantial. So regulators want banks to conserve their strong capital buffers as much as possible, really.
Jeroen, you know, I know we've been talking about European banks and some of the challenges they have broadly defined just in their core businesses. But as we look to the balance sheet and capital levels and reserves, do we still have that regional difference where, you know, the southern European banks, maybe the Italians and the Spanish, are still, you know, maybe undercapitalized vis-a-vis some of their northern European, Western European peers?
Well, both the Italian and the Spanish banks have made huge strides in improving their loan book quality heading into this crisis. And even last year, you saw that trend continue. You know, Intesa and UniCredit, they've successfully reduced their stack of non-performing loans.
Well, it was a pleasure to talk with you, Jeroen Julius, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Credit Analyst. Interesting stuff, Paul.
Yes, that's this week's edition of Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
And remember, you can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on your terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 57 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.